welcome to the second season of the GW Wonkcast, your home for in-depth analysis and discussions of pertinent policy issues. Before we go too much further, please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes. With that out of the way, let's introduce the panel today.
I'm Haley Dunn.
I'm Matt Dotzler.
And I'm Mike Steinberg, and I'm going to be the special guest today.
Excellent. So our first segment is something we like to call Below the Fold, where we each briefly discuss a policy matter you may have missed due to the bold headlines. Who'd like to go first? All right.
So this is from an article that I read in the New York Times in the Upshot. And it was talking about how there's been some talk with conservatives recently who oppose the ACA, claiming that Medicaid expansion may be fueling the opioid epidemic. And most recently, Senator Ron Johnson, who's a Republican from Wisconsin, has been claiming this. So this is something that they investigated to see if there's any merit to it. So on the surface, it seems like there could be some logic or data to support it. The 31 states that expanded Medicaid experienced a larger increase in drug overdoses between 2013 and 2015 than those that did not. Also, coverage from any insurance plays a role in access to prescription opioids. And many Medicaid enrollees tend to be prescribed opioids more frequently than those with other types of coverage. Although it's important to remember that those on Medicaid are often sicker than those with other types of coverage. But since we are all policy aficionados, we know that correlation does not imply causation. So,
zing!
So, in any case, the explosion in opioid abuse and overdose deaths is a trend that started much earlier than both the ACA's implementation in 2010 and 2013, which is the year that year before most states expanded Medicaid. So the increase in opioid deaths in the states that expanded Medicaid actually began in 2010, which would be before the expansion. It's also entirely possible that states experiencing higher rates of opioid deaths were more eager to expand Medicaid, which provides financial support for drug abuse treatment. You know, if we're supposing that Medicaid coverage does mean more opioid deaths, we'd expect to see higher rates of overdose in states or counties that previously had higher rates of uninsured, and therefore higher rates of uptake in Medicaid. But actually, the opposite is true. I think it's also, this issue is very politicized, because if you're just talking about insurance and the relationship between being insured and the opioid crisis, you don't have to focus on Medicaid. And it's interesting that the people who are criticizing it aren't bringing up issues with private insurance. So just think on that.
All right, excellent. Thanks. Who's next?
I'll go ahead and take it. So not so much in U.S. news, but largely reported still in Europe. Russia is currently conducting its Zapad 2017 military drills. These are exercises that are taking place in Belarus. There's an estimated, I think they said 13,000 soldiers with a full array of military weaponry, electronic warfare. And what it's looking like, especially to Eastern European allies, is a mock invasion of Eastern Europe. These former Soviet states that have for quite a while now lived in the fear that Russia would come back. NATO is worried as well, especially with several of these states recently joining. Is this a question of Russia making a power move and testing NATO resolve? So with Europe already facing a migrant crisis, you know, this has really taken a back burner for political discussion. And here in the United States, the Trump administration and the State Department have largely failed to comment on the issue. Again, calling into question whether or not this is going to stress ties with NATO and our Eastern European allies, or if Russia is going to be able to advance a little bit more of its agenda in the region.
Excellent. Thank you.
Well, my Below the Fold also has to do with Russian aggression or espionage, you could say. So the U.S. government, Department of Homeland Security acting director Elaine Duke, moved to ban software from that was produced by Kaspersky Lab. Agencies have 90 days to get any software produced by this company off of their servers. There are concerns about the founder of this company having ties to the Kremlin, was trained in Kremlin cryptography practices. The software that this company produced is around in a number of agencies federally, and it's also in a number of state agencies. So the Department of Homeland Security and GSA are pressuring agencies in state and local governments as well to get these this software off their computers because it could provide a security, or it could prove to be a security risk, which obviously is something that's a little bigger story in the news right now, but this is sort of a backdoor way that we could be, you know, having our government spied on by Russians. So,
and I guess I'll wrap this up with my below the fold, which is less of a news story and more of an explainer. So a lot of you may have heard that Senator Sanders recently introduced a Medicare for All bill that was backed by just about every 2020 Democratic hopeful. However, there seems to be some confusion about the difference between Medicare for All, a public plan, and what universal coverage is. So I'm going to basically use my below the fold time to explain the basic differences rather than give a unique policy matter. So firstly, universal coverage simply means every single person having health care. This can be arrived at by many mechanisms. It does not have to be government provided. It can be privately provided. Universal coverage is something that people like to talk about when they like to give lofty ideas of having everyone be covered without actually giving any descriptive. Medicare for All is one of the mechanisms you could get to universal coverage. Medicare, as some of us may know, is the aged into government healthcare system that has been one of the mostly widely successful programs. It has very low overhead, very successful in its costs. And because of its large user pool, it can really negotiate on drug prices. And so one of the things that Bernie Sanders' bill does is it will incrementally lower the age in for Medicare, and thus making it a Medicare for All. Everyone always be on a Medicare program. And finally, a public option. Medicare for All would be a public option, but when people talk about a public option, it just means the government providing health care. Some of us who paid attention to the Obamacare fight the first time around may remember that Joe Lieberman actually struck down the public option that would have been involved in the Obamacare exchanges. One of the fears was that the Obamacare exchange with a public option, people would choose a public option because it'd be more cost-effective, and thus the public option would phase out the ones that are less competitive and more expensive, the private options, creating a socialized Medicare system. The problem with that is you just said that the reason you don't want a public option is because it'd be more affordable and more effective than a private option. So that to me suggests that their motives might be not quite pure. Anyway, that is my below the fold. I hope it was a helpful explainer. And when we come back, Mike will be talking about AI and tech. Welcome back. We are now going to turn to Mike and talk about AI and tech. So, Mike, why should I care about artificial intelligence?
Well, I think it's a really important issue right now for the U.S. I think the bottom line is that it's expanding. There's a lot of AI around us right now that we don't even think about, something like cruise control or chatbots for customer service. You've got machine learning algorithms that are doing everything from sentencing to teacher grading, and these are being deployed in everyday life right now. So it's one of those areas where yes, there's going to be a long road to see how it develops over the next few decades, but it's also something that we can begin thinking about right now. It's as far as the tech world goes, it's one of those top topics. And I think another key component of all of this, not only are we starting to see it now, but we're starting to ask questions of, will there be worker displacement? Will there be privacy concerns about collecting data, or what kind of data you can feed into these algorithms and AI and stuff like that?
Could you talk about either one of those or both, like, in a little bit more detail? Like, I'm really interested in criminal justice, so for me, the idea of an algorithm determining sentencing decisions is super alarming.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just give a little more background on that?
So, yeah, I just recently read Kathy O'Neill's Weapons of Math Destruction, and that's a lot of her point in the book, is that algorithms have started to get very closed, that people don't really know what's inside of them at the end of the day, and they're getting more power in that if a teacher gets a bad evaluation, nobody really asks why or whether or not that was a good teacher that just got a bad evaluation. They say, you got a bad evaluation, now we're gonna have to fire you.
That was an issue here in D.C.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's exactly what she used that example. And the sentencing kind of goes the same way. Nobody really asks well, what are we putting in this algorithm to make it say that this person is more likely to commit a crime once they get out of jail again? So I think...
Is that what they're using it for? I don't know much about it.
Yeah, so that's kind of what it is that it's like a score that basically shows up and says, we think this person has a X amount of chance of committing a crime again, so here...
Wow.
So put this in their parole decision sort of thing. And they use different factors... Some of them are escaping me.
Very alarming.
Yeah, it's alarming, but also if you think about it, what is the criminal justice system trying to do? It's trying to find truth. It's trying to find out what is the right...
Think it is.
Yeah, I'm gonna
the law is not about what's true.
I was going to have to push back on that one, saying that by quantifying someone's potential risk, you can therefore deter, keep them in jail for actions that they have not yet committed. I think that's...
I'll actually argue a counter to that one. There was an article that came out a little while ago that did talk about using AI algorithms and whatnot to figure somebody's risk, but it wasn't on the back end, it was on the front end when deciding bail.
Chicago.
Yeah. And I seem to recall, and I read this a little while ago, so pardon me if I don't have it all here, that more and more individuals were being given the chance to walk out of the courtroom without needing to post a bail. That, you know, they had effectively shown that these individuals are not at risk either for repeat or fleeing, and that they'll come back. So in a positive aspect, you know, the algorithm kept people out of jail, you know, at least until the trial started.
The problem with that is that the only reason that bails are set so high in general is because of systemic racist issues in general.
Yeah,
so
that's a
right. It just seems
that,
like,
that was the point.
The bail
I was
system
get to.
Is awful.
That to me seems like you're using AI to fix a system that should have been fixed. Because it's, like, a racist
system.
So,
no, that's a huge problem, though, in AI and algorithms, is, at the end of the day,
yeah,
a lot of times they do build in our own biases.
I was about to ask,
yeah,
how do you prevent an algorithm?
And the answer is you make better algorithms. Is that...
But, like, how? You can't, get outside.
You use more data. You use more data. You feed it more data, and you say, hey, we released...
So doesn't the programmer always put their signature on their code, right? I mean, what if they say, like... Simply judge this person more harshly because of the XY factors, except one of those factors happens to be the fact that it's a black male.
Right.
It's probably not how they would do it either. They would say, like, if you're from this neighborhood or, like, this address, you're more at risk.
Yes, and that's exactly what I think her book kind of goes into a little bit, is that, yes, at the end of the day, it is more addresses... You know, oh, do you know somebody that's committed a crime? Well,
yeah.
If you're in one of those neighborhoods, you probably know somebody that committed a crime. And I think one of the recommendations she made at the end of the book, which I kind of agree with, is that I think the big thing is making these more transparent and also not making them total control elements of actually bringing back the human into it a little bit and saying, like, you know, making it one part of the score. I think the end of that DC teacher evaluation scandal turned into... Okay, we're going to use these, and they're going to be in the evaluations because we still want to know this information of how kids are doing on test scores, but we're not going to fire people tomorrow because they got a bad score on it.
Yeah.
Like, I think the example she knew one of the examples I heard was that somebody got a 6 one year and a 96 the next year. At that point, you're not really measuring how good a teacher is. You're just measuring the kids in the class or, honestly, randomness.
Go ahead.
I have a clarifying question before we go any farther. So could you define what you mean by AI? Because some of the things that you've mentioned, like cruise control, like, I wouldn't think of that as AI in terms of, like, artificial intelligence. Like, how are we defining that versus just something that's automated or computer run?
So I think there is a distinction between, right, the basic AI, but it's still using a computer. And what it does is, the thing about AI, it involves feeding a data set into a computer and then training that data set to not only... you know, identify things, but then act on it on top of it. So the example I'm probably going to continue to bring up is self-driving cars. It's something that's coming up right now. And what companies are doing is they'll feed into a main computer a data set of images, whether it be stoplights or roadways. And, you know, they'll feed that image into the computer. And then the computer can then say, oh, that's a red light. That means I now need to use my brake mechanism and stop the car. And they use scanners to be able to survey the area. So AI is both a little bit of identifying, you know, using data to identify situations, but then also acting on that as well.
And so where then is the policy implication, or where does, from my perspective, I'm someone who studies, like, regulations. Where then is, like, the regulatory impact? Is it, do we start regulating the computer? Is it about the data we put into it? Where is the point that we should be more concerned about? Is it what we give the computer or what the computer gives to us?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question because I think that, first of all, AI touches every field. You could talk about education, you could talk about social policy, you could talk about infrastructure. It's going to involve all of those. As far as where we're going to regulate, I think it kind of depends on the field or the specific AI, because AI at the end of the day is really just a tool. And so, you know, self-driving cars are going to have a certain type of regulation that you may need to regulate roadways differently or liability differently. But then if I talk about like an algorithm or like a Siri, then we're talking about data privacy or something like that. What data can companies collect? So it's almost like you need industry specific solutions to it.
So as far as then the future of where AI is taking us, something you talked about was labor displacement, which is something that people have talked about for a long time about why we're losing jobs. Most of the research would show that it's not from low priced labor as much as it's from computer driven labor automation. So is that something we should be expecting more? And if so, what is the prudent response to AI in the workforce?
So I think that's another question where I think there's a lot of predictions out there right now. There are some reports that'll say driverless cars alone will lose millions and millions of dollars. Millions and millions of jobs. Or you could say, well, you know, think about something like a school bus, right? You may think that, well, I'm going to replace that driver. I'm going to replace that job with automation. But let's be real. You're going to still want a chaperone on that. So that's going to be a new job sort of thing. It's not that jobs are necessarily going away because of AI, it's that they're shifting. You may need a new skill. So instead of being a driver, we may need you to know how to run a remote of it or program it or something like that. Those skills are still necessary. So I don't necessarily, I think the projections, there are some absolutely out of this world projections about job loss. And I don't know if those are necessarily confounded, because if you think about it, back when when the cars first came out, in general, you had an entire blacksmith industry that overnight became an automobile industry. And I think there's a great report we'll put up the link for, but I think we're not even seeing that type of turnover right now because of AI. So it's always something that should be on these legislators' mind, because yes, at the end of the day, we do have to explain to our voters why their job was automated, but at the same time, it's not that, you know, as an economy as a whole, we're losing millions and millions of jobs every day.
Does that kind of rely on us having an infrastructure in place for retraining programs, though? And if so, could you explain a little bit more about some of that?
So, yeah, I'm definitely for retraining programs. I think that that's something.
What shape do those take?
So I think it could take, it almost depends also with, like, career-wise of, if you're a mid-career in your 50s, retraining you to do something like coding when you've been a coal miner your entire life, you may not have that aptitude maybe late in life to learn. That's a different problem to deal with than, say, the 20-something-year-old, where we can, you know, put in place some different areas where they can learn how to maybe code early on. So,
but what about things other than coding that would then be applicable? Because this sounds like what you just said was coding. The option is coding. Like that can't be the solution here.
I remember someone saying at some point that in the future we would need all kinds of professions that just deal with fixing robots. So, like, you'd be like a robot surgeon.
Like a machinist.
Yeah.
So that's, that's the alternative then, to coding as being a machinist.
So, yeah, my concern with all of these things is that, so especially when I'm thinking about, like, what our society is going to look like 50 years from now when, you know, not only do we have driverless cars, but we have, like, you know, robots that will clean for us, and we've basically replaced all low-skill wages. I have multiple concerns about that. One is that there's always going to have to be people who are low-skilled and who have those kind of labor. Either that's because, like, you know, they don't have the education, or, you know, for a variety of factors, there's always going to need to be that level in the economy. And I'm concerned that that is disappearing. If we're saying,
when you say there will need to be people who are low skilled, or there always will be,
I'm saying there's always going to be people who need low skilled labor. And so if those opportunities aren't there, not everyone can be a coder. And my other concern is that we're decreasing the choice of available life opportunities for people, because you can tell a coal miner, you know, and this also, I know this came up in the context of climate change as well, like, you need to be retrained to do this, but what if they don't want to? And I think that's a big thing. Like, I don't want to be a coder, and I'm hoping that being a policy analyst will continue forever.
Yeah.
But
say that, it probably won't. But my,
you know, maybe a computer will be analyzed. I mean, yeah, I could easily see an algorithm deciding what policies are best based on some utilitarian formula.
And there are cost-benefit analysis computers that happen.
Yeah.
Even law firms, so much of it now is automated that it didn't used to be, that those used to be low-skill jobs.
That ties us back to two things. One, our very first episode of Longcast, but universal basic income.
Right.
But we're not going to talk about that. But to me, it also raises this current issue that we're facing right now with displaced low-skill labor and trade adjustment assistance, and how that hasn't been very effective. People who lose their jobs to, you know, international trade and can prove it are benefit from trade adjustment assistance, and that has been a very ineffective program. So it just seems odd that we would say that we can rely on this type of like technological adjustment assistance when we can't even do trade adjustment assistance.
Mm-hmm. It's not something that I think we're going to see that much job displacement. It's just one of those things that economically would never make sense in this context, because I think a better investment's in innovation. Because think about the iPhone. You know, if we just said, oh, well, we're afraid that this is going to put out of business telephone lines or something like that. But we just created the app economy. We created so many other jobs because of this innovation. So I think that that's more of, on the macroeconomic side, that's where, you know, I think that we need to see more investments. But I think it does boil down again to more.
I guess just like my point continually is that because our society has so much structural inequality that, you know, even if there's an opportunity for, you know, a new market like the apps, not everyone has an equal opportunity to participate as a supplier in that market.
Mm-hmm.
And that is my concern, that we are getting rid of jobs that people need because they don't have access due to inequality issues. And I mean, I'm not asking you to solve that problem. But, I'm just saying, like, I'm hoping that this coincides with, I think we need a huge structural societal shift in how our labor system is set up.
But also, just to kind of counter that a little bit, something like Uber, though, yes, maybe it put out of work taxi cab drivers, but then we created a whole new economy that was more efficient with our sort of innovation. So it's almost like, yeah, kind of going back to your point earlier about, yes, we're always going to need low-skilled labor. It's just that our needs for that low-skilled labor are going to change, and they're going to shift.
It's going to look
different. Right, it's going to look different. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think that's kind of my point to drive home.
From a foreign policy security perspective, of course, that's where I'm going to come from with this. You know, cyber warfare is starting to replace conventional in a lot of situations. And if we talk about AI as running our cars, being in our homes, replacing a lot of those labor jobs, you know, it's a question of whether or not we can secure it.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that, you know, an outside hacker or group would be able to get a hold of and then, you know, significantly impact our lives at home or, you know, the production and function of our society? You know, I don't think that's a question that's ever going to get answered, but AI in that scenario, especially if it is a little more freestanding and able to learn, you know, poses a threat even in some of the simplest tasks.
I mean, I've seen Terminator. What Matt's saying is, like, it sounds like it's inevitable. How can we move into this AI technology world without this, you know, this
threat? Without weaponizing it.
Yeah, without weaponizing, exactly.
Seems to be human nature.
Yeah. Now, the Internet of Things right now, they call it.
Yeah.
And, like, people are hacking into our lives through our refrigerators. How can we expect a smarter world if we can't even protect our refrigerator?
You know, I think the thing about technology is that it's only as good as the cybersecurity. And as with everything else in life, there is, you know, good education and bad education.
We just kicked out Kaspersky from our government. So clearly we're not doing so great.
Right. And so I think the answer to that is not, well, let's just disconnect from the web. Let's not, you know, I think you guys are kind of going on the strain a lot of what Elon Musk talks about. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the founder of Tesla, a lot of other really moonshot type technologies. But yeah, that's his worldview for the next 50 years, is that eventually robots will rule us all, they'll start killing people in the streets, and it'll be too late to regulate them. And I think AI is just more likely to be something like, you know, a Siri or an Alexa, that it's more of a home assist, or it's more of something that's going to make your life more simple rather than something that will just immediately go out of control.
So, your opinion, do you think that the industry has put the cart before the horse in terms of security and AI development?
I think they just go hand in hand is the thing. Is you can't have AI development, you can't have Internet of Things without much stronger cybersecurity, particularly going back to our below the fold in government, is that the private sector has enough trouble as it is keeping up with cybersecurity trends. I think there is even more panic in the government about how far behind IT systems are and how easy it would be to hack into, you know, think about the OPM hack a few years ago, that, you know, these problems are fixable if we know how to react to them and kind of anticipate that, you know, anticipate cybersecurity problems. But as far as regulatory things go, I think a lot of times you will get burdensome regulations that, you know, so Elon Musk's favorite talking point is like a robot tax or something like that, to disincentivize people from developing robots. But I don't think that that's, I think that's just trying to stop something that's probably more inevitable than anything, because it's just a demand thing. It's like Alexa's a very popular item. So Amazon just made money off of it. Guess what they're going to do? They're probably going to keep pushing forward with more AI, and then other companies are going to look at Alexa, Google, you know, and they're going to develop their own AI. So it's one of the, and I think this is the same in the self-driving car debate, is Tesla has an autopilot feature right now. So, I mean.
But one of the things that Matt was saying, that one of the things is, are we putting, you know, the AI before the horse? With automated cars, I know that NHTSA has recently put out a rule about vehicle-to-vehicle communication, and how they're trying to standardize a single mechanism by which all cars will communicate, a single channel, basically. Because right now, every vehicle is communicating on a different channel. So, like, all the Buicks are talking to each other, but none of the Buicks are talking to Teslas. All the Teslas are talking to each other, but they're not talking to, like, the Toyotas. And so they're trying to standardize this single mechanism by which all the cars can talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so this seems to me like what Matt was getting at, like, how can we preempt these technological changes that are inevitable, but do it, you know, prior to the fact, opposed to this post hoc regulatory action?
I think there's some areas where you're going to be able to do that. Going back to the self-driving cars, a place like Nashville right now is actually updating their infrastructure so that the AI can read the stoplights or the stop signs. And, you know, if you think about, that could be a problem in more rural areas, but at least one city's kind of going into this situation and trying to figure out what are those problems. So, and then there are other areas where, you know, you should just kind of wait and see, that we don't really know what the challenges of the next generation of AI are going to look like. And when we, you know, when lawmakers and regulatory agencies get to that area, then that's when we can make the laws. But it's one of those things to just say AI as a whole is bad is not looking at the nuances of the issue. So that's, I think, the thing, though, is it's not algorithms are horrible, we all have to run away from it. It's algorithms are tools, AI are tools that are meant to supplement the human being.
Give our bit about something we see in the news that we think has either been good, bad, or ugly. This is a bit of a mic drop moment. We say our bit and move on. Who wants to go first?
I'll start us off with something, I guess it falls under the category of ugly. It's a little more interesting than anything. So last month, New America Foundation, a big think tank here in D.C., recently split with its open market group, led by a guy named Barry Lynn, and they supposedly had a dispute over the open markets section of their foundation, writing a couple anti-trust articles related to Google. Google turns out to be a big funder of New America, so the open markets center basically accused them of playing favorites with their sponsor, and it was kind of dragged out in the mud, but I think it was kind of interesting to look at sort of where the split is almost in the Democratic Party a little bit, because one side was talking really strongly about antitrust issues. The other side, which was New America, is a left-leaning think tank, and they were supporting Google. And there's a lot of things that Silicon Valley, their values line up a lot with the Democratic Party in terms of immigration, education, lots of other issues like that. So I think it's kind of going to be interesting to watch, but it was an ugly public dispute.
All right, excellent. Matt?
All right, I've got a little bit more of a good. The Trump administration has actually gone ahead with two appointments to State Department positions. The first one is Wes Mitchell being confirmed today in front of the Senate, actually, as the Assistant Secretary of European and Eurasian Affairs, and John Huntsman as Ambassador to Russia. So at a time when the State Department is appearing to be woefully understaffed and the diplomatic atmosphere in peril, this is a step in the right direction with two very qualified individuals taking lead positions. Wes being the founder of the Center for European Policy Analysis and an expert on Eastern Europe and Russia. He brings with him some serious poise. His hair is always on point. And a skeptical outlook on Russia that will serve as a breath of fresh air not only for the public, but also in an administration that seems a little infatuated. John Huntsman, as well, is a former ambassador to China, 2009-2011. He was in that post when China was really stepping out onto the global stage. 16th governor of Utah, and much like Wes, Huntsman shows a lot of promise in his ability to tackle tough situations and appears ready to meet Russia head on. So a little bit of good in the news today. The State Department has some leadership.
Excellent. Thank you. So I was going to talk about the place that local sheriff's been placed in by either having to violate the civil rights of the people they're detaining until ICE shows up, or being faced to be held in contempt of DOJ, but I'm not going to talk about that ugly thing. The ugly thing I'm going to talk about instead is the fact that the police officers in St. Louis have decided to use the protest chant, "Whose Streets, Our Streets," while chasing down protesters. And to me, that is the most disgusting thing imaginable. The streets do not belong to the police officers. It is their sworn duty to protect the people. It is not their streets. It is the people's streets. And it is shameful and disgusting that they're doing that. So that's my ugly thing. On that note, thank you all for listening. We will see you in 2 weeks.
This show is edited by Nathan Rupp, produced by Haley Dunn, and music by Pelly Gunther.